Hey, deserving listeners, Johnny Depp, Amber Heard trial, let's watch. My name is Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and a professor. As I always say, everything that I say in reaction to this is mostly speculative based on the information provided to us. So keep that in mind. I usually word things as such. Sometimes people think I'm diagnosing from afar, and I'm very careful not to. If I ever make a mistake, you know, feel free to point it out to me, because that is against my principles and what I believe to be my ethical codes, contrary to what is being presented here.
So someone could have every single risk factor for IPV and never commit IPV, right?
It would be, again, if you're going to say a medical degree of probability, the answer is they will. But if you're saying uniformly, the answer is no.
Right.
I didn't show all the footage, but the lawyers going after him regarding correlation, causation, there was a bit of a weird conversation around that. But now they're talking about risk factors versus actual reality, which doesn't map on directly to correlation and causation. But the lawyer's trying to point out, look, you pointed at risk factors that Johnny Depp may have committed IPV, but that doesn't mean he did commit IPV. The expert witness is trying to dodge that a little bit. So on one hand, he's saying, yes, it's not an automatic indication. Then he said like 0.5% chance. And I'm like, no, I mean, that's not the way I would character. The risk factors in IPV that he identified was drug abuse. And he also said narcissism, right? Which of course, that whole dubiousness. What other risk factor did you say? Childhood abuse, did he mention that? So the lawyer is smart to go after that and say, like, it's a risk factor, but it doesn't mean he actually was abusive to Amber Heard. And let's hear his response, because on one hand, I think he says that's true, but from a medical probability, it is. So let's rewind that.
It would be, again, if you're going to say a medical degree of probability, the answer is they will. But if you're saying uniformly, the answer is no.
Right. That's what I thought he said. He answers it a little squirrely, but I think he's saying, medically speaking, yes, if you have the risk factors, you have done it, which is ridiculous, of course, especially when you just, well, even if you had 15 risk factors, that, you know, doesn't mean that someone's abusive. And then he says, you know, uniformly, meaning like every single human who abuses drugs is abusive to their partner. No. Now, is there a high prevalence of violence in relationships where people are abusing drugs and alcohol to the level that Johnny Depp was using? Yeah, there is a high prevalence. I don't remember the exact statistic, but given what we heard from Johnny Depp, I would never think, oh, they must be automatically violent. And that's only just violence. We don't even know about abuse, right? There's violence, and then there's actual an abusive cycle of control and coercion. Yeah, he's not saying something that is supported by science. He says, medically, if you have that risk factor, then yes, you can say that someone is abusive to their partner because you have identified risk factors. Like, no.
IPV can occur without substance abuse?
Oh, sure.
Someone can abuse substances without ever perpetrating IPV?
Again, absolutely. But, again, you are saying, different than what I said, I did not say abusing substances. I said substance use disorder. Those are two different things, because there are surely people who use substances that do not engage.
So by implication, everyone with substance use disorder is abusive to their partner? Like, no. This is kind of hard to research because you have to, one, get self-report data from people as to whether or not they've perpetrated or been a victim. And two, you have to get self-report data as to whether or not they were intoxicated and how much they were intoxicated. So we can rely on police reports maybe, but those are just the ones that happen to involve the police. And of course, the police don't necessarily do a field sobriety test. And even if you did, you wouldn't know if they were intoxicated on something other than alcohol. But anyway, for people who are, this one study among male alcoholics in treatment, 20 to 33% reported having assaulted their wives at least once in the year prior to the survey. Their wives reported even higher rates, so we don't know what that rate was. So let's say the wives reported something like 50% or something. What does that say about Johnny Depp? It says that there's a percentage chance given statistics, but it doesn't say anything about Johnny Depp.
Any violence does not become psychotic, nothing at all. So,
and that's
absolutely
equally true of people who have substance abuse disorder. There are certainly people who have substance abuse disorder who don't commit IPV, correct?
They are saying people who have substance use disorders, the majority of them, over 50% do. So over 50% do, so that's...
So he is pointing at maybe a consensus around over 50%. Okay, so like 53%, 55%? Okay.
So the answer is yes.
As you said, not everyone who smokes gets lung cancer.
So there are significant numbers of people. You said it was over 50, so you'd say 40% of the people who have substance abuse disorder don't commit IPV?
And those are the ones that do not have IPV risk factors, though, right? So we're talking about people
who don't. Wait a minute. Isn't substance abuse disorder an IPV risk factor?
Oh, yeah. These are other people that don't have other risk
factors. Okay, he's being squirrely, which I think expert witnesses are trained to do on cross examination. So he's pinning him down. Very good job by the lawyer. So you're saying that 40%+ of people with a substance use disorder, they don't commit IPV. And the answer, of course, is yes, because that's precisely what he was saying. Now, was Johnny Depp violent with Amber Heard? Was he abusive with Amber Heard? It's absolutely possible. He was clearly verbally abusive, so we saw that. Would I be surprised if he was abusive at times to some degree? No, I would not be surprised. It's just that when we have professionals who are,
That is right.
But again, we're talking about people in general. You don't know anything about any particular individual as to whether anybody's going to commit IPV.
If statistics follow through, all we can say is more than 50%, 70% will. If you combine more risk factors you have, the more likely you're going to develop the illness. If you smoke cigarettes once, that might not correlate to lung cancer. If you smoke it chronically.
Okay, so in this instance, he's actually doing a good job of being squirrely to cross-examination in that he's answering it accurately without providing wrong information and research, but he is implying that because Johnny Depp has a number of risk factors, drug and alcohol abuse, but also and poly substance use in particular, and also his childhood abuse history. Well, he would say narcissism, of course, which is possible, but how could he possibly know that? And what he's implying, and I think it might be working on the jury, that because he's an expert and he has taken into account all of the risk factors, the chance that he was abusive is basically almost 100%. He's not saying that directly, though, but he's implying it. I think that might convince a couple jurors.
About the traits, right?
Yes.
If somebody can have these narcissistic personality traits and substance abuse disorder and never commit IPV, right?
So, along that line,
right.
About 80-90% of people who commit IPV have a personality disorder. So the answer is less than about 10% obviously do not.
That doesn't answer the question. Is that even true? Yes, it is true. Precisely. This research by Hart et al., 2011, 80-90%. But the method here, MCMI-2 results, I've talked about that test before, indicated that 80-90% of men who were wife assaulters, they're saying, suffered from a personality disorder. Okay, so one, the MCMI-2 is not a strong indication of a personality disorder. It's a hypothesis, a starting point, but the MCMI has a lot of false positives. So that is one. Two, that doesn't answer the question. What he's saying is most people who are abusive have a personality disorder. Okay, but that's the complete opposite of what he's asking. What he's asking is people who have personality disorders, people who have substance use disorders, there are some of those people who don't commit IPV, which is true.
There are more close links with IPV for borderline personality disorder the narcissistic personality disorder, correct, sir?
I'm not going to agree with that.
No?
I'm not saying there are more links. I would say to you, there are absolute, if you're asking me there are links, the answer is absolutely. If you're saying to me more, I can show studies, say yes, show studies, say no. That has not been absolutely definitively correlated.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen that research, or I don't remember seeing it. But yeah, that would be my sense, is that one, narcissism, borderline are probably at least similar in terms of their rates of intimate partner. I mean, I don't even know why they're going down the road of narcissistic personality. It's like, don't even agree with that diagnosis. That's a ridiculous call that he is making based on extremely limited information. But yeah, I suspect that's probably true, that there are studies that show that there's this and that. And that's the nature of our business. Like, people often ask me, what's the prevalence of cheating? People who are concerned that their partner is cheating, or they've been cheated on in the past, or they've had a number of cheating partners in the past, or they cheated themselves, and they're worried that it's going to happen again. And they're like, have I been through something odd, or is this just normal? Because that alarms me. And people will email in and ask me, what's the prevalence rate of cheating? And again, it's all self-report. You literally have to ask people, have you cheated on someone, or have you ever been cheated on? Which is even a sillier question, because if someone cheated on you and you didn't know about it, then how would you know? So how do you define cheating, right? Because if it's intercourse, then that's cheating. Or is flirting online or sending a naked photograph? Of course, a lot of people would consider that to be cheating. So it depends on the study, depends on what the definition is, depends on the population and the age group and the cohort and all this kind of stuff. And so you will find, whenever they cite research, they'll say the prevalence of cheating is anywhere between 25% and 75%, something like that. Or even, there might even be a greater range. The other thing is, do you include relationships that are in high school? Because there might be a higher rate of cheating at that time. Do you only include relationships of a certain length? And do you say the prevalence that someone has cheated in their life at some point, or that an individual relationship will experience cheating? There's a lot of different ways of coming at it statistically. And so it's just hard to know. The point, though, that the lawyers bring up is that, okay, fine, if you're going to say that about Johnny Depp, then are you also saying that about Amber Heard? That's an absolute valid point. And there's much more data to demonstrate that she, Amber Heard, suffers from borderline, and not any data that Johnny Depp suffers from narcissistic personality.
Diagnosis or findings that Mr. Depp exhibited narcissistic traits or had that disorder. Do you recall that testimony?
Yes.
All right. And the question was asked of you of the whether if you have 5 of 9 narcissistic traits. Do you remember that testimony?
Yes.
Okay. Now, one of the ones you testified before was for narcissism, it requires admiration, correct?
Yes.
What, if any, record evidence was there that Mr. Depp requires admiration?
The very people that surround him need to admire him, or they're no longer in his employment or his working circle.
Okay, goody. We are actually going to get a clear explanation of the data that he used to diagnose Johnny Depp with narcissistic personality disorder traits. Need for admiration. Give us your data for that. He says, well, everyone who is employed by Johnny Depp needs to be in constant admiration of him. How did he make that decision? Did he ask the employees? Was there an account of that? What did people go on the record and say, yeah, he constantly required me to admire him all the time? I'm just going to take a guess and say that if that existed in the record, it would be presented to us. Maybe it will be one day. So, okay, I can't really speak to that because I've actually skipped ahead to him, and there's a section of Amber Heard's testimony and some other witnesses, like the sister, and that I haven't seen, but I will get to eventually. So maybe that was presented, but even then, I can't, well, if there were a lot of accounts of that, then okay. You know, for example, let's say that you had a politician who required that twice a day he is given a list of all the positive tweets about him. That would be a sign of narcissistic personality disorder. Would I diagnose based on hearing that? No. Absolutely not. Everyone has a need for admiration, particularly people in the public eye. I have a need for admiration. I am frequently basing my self-esteem on whether or not people like what I post on the internet. I will look at the statistics of how many likes I get and go like, how am I going to feel today about myself? Am I a good person? And any content provider that says otherwise is either some other human that I've never heard of before, or they're lying, or they're unaware or something, or they're not into what they're doing. You know, like when I cook something, for example, I don't have any pride in that. And so if it sucks, like I don't really care because I don't take personal pride. I imagine most content providers do take some pride, if not tremendous pride, in their products. So of course they're interested. I have a need for admiration. Now, he's not pointing at data along those lines. He's saying that Johnny Depp forced other people to admire him. Okay, so let me give you an idea. So this will be good. If they go through the criteria, I will tell you typical examples from my practice that will fit this criterion. One example that I can give, and this is somewhat common, that someone, narcissistic personality disordered individuals often are very concerned with how they're perceived at work and in the world. And when they come home to their family, they often will have a lot of pent up tension around narcissistic supply. And since their family are either in a good relationship with them or intimidated by them, they will come home and say frequently, perhaps every day, they'll impose certain demands on their family to admire what they did at work that day. So, for example, they might come home and say, oh my God, so-and-so said this, but then I said this, which really put them in their place, right? There's a clear emotional pressure, if not a direct question of like, that was awesome, right? You know, but usually it's implied. And if you don't go, wow, you know, the way that I explain it to people is think of like a second grader or a, you know, that age of children. It's not strange to have a kid draw a picture that is almost incomprehensible and they show it to you and they're like, I drew your face. It's awesome. You know, by any measure, you're like, this picture is not awesome. But you say, it looks great. And the kid's like, yay. You know, if you gave your honest opinion about the drawing, you would probably destroy them. And we all understand that, right? Well, for narcissistic personality individuals, they retain that mechanism. They never grow out of it because they were never given enough attunement, care, you know, stability to actually grow out of that. And they rely on that mechanism of superiority to give them some semblance of self-esteem throughout the day, which they're constantly running away from, not only low self-esteem, but just like the complete emptiness and abyss that they feel they are on the inside. And so a common example is they come home and they might talk for 2 hours at you, and you get the picture if you're with this person. Oh, I just have to listen to them. Another need for admiration that's a little not obvious is they might lecture a lot. They might sit you down and just yammer at you either about things that they know about or criticizing you. And they need you to say, oh, wow, you're so smart, you know, or there has to be some kind of vibe that you believe that they're smart because they're in this constant treadmill trying to get narcissistic supply. And if they just come home and say, how was your day? And, you know, mine was fine. There's no opportunity for that constant narcissistic supply. So those are the kinds of things that I will see. Now, if I heard that from someone, I wouldn't go narcissistic personality disorder, but it would give me a line of data to pursue further. Now, and another thing that I'll get from narcissistic individuals is when they're talking to me, they kind of do that to me. And I feel it on the inside. I feel this, there's a feeling of fear that I will feel because I feel pressured. I feel like I'm cornered. I feel like the individual through conversation is kind of cornering me and that doesn't feel very safe to me. And I also have this feeling of, am I supposed to be complimenting them right now? I don't understand. Are they looking, are they trying to tell me something that they want me to praise them in this moment? I don't understand. Like, there's not really much to praise there. And plus, they're a grown adult. So, but then over time, like, oh, I get it. And actually, the corrective experience involved. Anyway, Now, again, if he had data to support that they had to admire him that was strong, again, that would be in the direction, but it's not as clear to me as the examples I gave. But let's hear what else they say.
The second one that you discussed was sense of entitlement. Do you recall that testimony?
Yes.
All right. What record evidence is there that Mr. Depp exhibits behavior of needing a sense of entitlement?
So, again, thinking that Ms. Heard was marrying him solely for his money and his influence, and that was the case, was, in my opinion, very entitled.
All right. And
now, I don't know what he's basing that on. I don't have access to all the records he has. If there's a strong indication, but even so, I don't think anyone believes that to be true, that Johnny Depp, in general, believed that. If anything, that shows he's insecure. It's not narcissistic. It would be narcissistic to think, well, of course she wants to be with me because I'm awesome, because everyone wants to be with me. That would be narcissistic. But to say the only reason why she wants to be with me is because of my fame and money, that says you're insecure. Entitled, I suppose, would be, I am rich and famous. You must be with me. I deserve you. That's entitlement. Plus, I'm pretty sure that if he said such a thing, or if someone said he said such a thing, that was in the midst of a fight or something. I don't think anyone believes, including Amber Heard, that Johnny Depp thought the only reason why she was with him is because he was rich and famous. I think everyone in that relationship and around them thought they were in a relationship because they were in love with each other, and they triggered each other's issues and they became entangled. So entitlement. Let me give you a typical clinical example of entitlement. I'm having a harder time thinking of a quintessential example, but this is an example. The narcissistic individual, she cheats and the spouse figures it out. There's a text or something that shows up on her phone and he sees this indication. It all comes out eventually, and she admits, yes, I have been cheating on you for a while. And the way she talks to him and other people, you know, she might say, well, things have been really tough lately, and you know, the pandemic and stuff, and he's really into the kids lately, and you just get the vibe that they just feel like they're entitled to cheat and lie and deceive because they want it, and they don't think about how it impacts other people. I mean, that's not a great example of entitlement, but that's the sort of thing that I will hear. And if I just heard that, I wouldn't know, and I have heard that clinically a number of times, I wouldn't know if they're in denial of the reality because they're so ashamed of themselves, or some other reasons as to why I would hear that from someone, or that they have narcissistic personality disorder and they just feel entitled. They're like, well, I'm special, or I want that, and so I will have it. There's also, you know, impaired empathy. They've been saying lack of empathy, which is often the way that people phrase it, but people with narcissistic personality disorder do have empathy in the same way that people with borderline and histrionic do, but there's impaired empathy because their issues eclipse their opportunity for empathy, is the way that I see it anyway.
The third one you discussed was exploitative. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Okay. And what is the record evidence that Mr. Depp exhibits behaviors of that are exploitative?
Again, I think the whole concept of abuse is exploitative.
Okay.
Okay. So if I saw someone that showed signs of narcissism and they were abusive, well, at the very least, I would want to know the way in which they were abusive, because just hearing that they're abusive wouldn't tell me much. So this one's harder to come up with a quintessential example, but one example that comes to mind is that when you have narcissistic personality disorder, and let's say you're at work and you're the boss because you're very interested in getting that narcissistic supply. So you're now in charge and you worked really hard to get there because you're on that constant treadmill of narcissistic supply. And then an underling, one of your subordinates, starts to get a lot of accolades, starts to get a lot of praise. And even though you're still getting a lot of praise, you're envious of that praise, and it by contrast doesn't make you feel constantly superior, and you're threatened by your subordinate getting some praise. And so you might, behind the scenes, undermine them by talking one-on-one with other employees, other subordinates or whoever, or even the people who are praising that individual, to plant seeds of doubt in the praise of that subordinate. And and when they finally stop giving praise or they agree behind closed doors that, oh, yeah, yeah, that's your subordinate is a problem. And then you feel better. That's an example.
Fourth one was lacks empathy. Do you recall that?
Yes.
And what is the record evidence that Mr. Depp exhibits lacking empathy?
To be able to commit intimate partner violence and the control you have over someone.
I'm sorry?
Can I be heard?
Okay.
Okay, so what I think he was going to say is that for someone to commit intimate partner violence indicates a general lack of empathy. Yeah, absolutely possible if you saw abusive behavior in person in someone, particularly I think what Amber Heard alleges, then the question of impaired or lack of empathy would be there. But certainly a lot of people who commit violence against their partners do not have a lack of empathy, or clinically speaking. You could say in those moments they are lacking of empathy, but in terms of a general personality trait that transcends all relationships, so that personality disorder follows them everywhere. So when you have a highly combative relationship and you say both people are exhibiting a lack of empathy for their partner, but in other arenas you don't see that behavior. I mean, if anything, a lot of people just without any prompting talked about how great he is. Now, you could argue that that's a sign of his narcissistic personality disorder. He has brainwashed everyone around him and manipulated all of them to admire him. And one of the ways that he does that is by being charming and appearing to be nice. Okay, yeah, maybe, but there's not any evidence of that. So common examples of lacking or impaired empathy that I will see in my practice, when they're being challenged in terms of their self-worth and or their narcissistic supply is drying up a little bit, that's when their lack of empathy becomes pronounced. When I treat people who have narcissistic personality disorder and I can manage to get them to a place either in session or even in general where their attachment needs are being met and they're not being threatened in any way, then they're absolutely able to be empathetic towards other people and caring. Sometimes it can be kind of primitive because they haven't had a lot of practice. And by the way, I want to delineate, because on the internet, a lot of people misunderstand narcissism with psychopathy or antisocial. In fact, I think most people, when they're saying that person's narcissistic, what they're actually identifying is psychopathy, meaning that the person generally lacks empathy. They're not impaired in terms of their empathy. They don't have empathy, or there's significant deficit in their empathy, and that shows up in all sorts of things, including what seems to be narcissistic, or what we would label as narcissistic. It's not narcissistic personality disorder, but it is self-centeredness and superiority, exploitation of others, callousness, crimes, lying, all these stealing from other people, that kind of stuff. Those are very, very different things. Now, they're considered to be in the same cluster of personality disorders. I really don't understand why. Certainly, narcissism, borderline histrionic are similar, but psychopathy, antisocial to me are unique given the foundation of it. So, but then there are different presentations of that. But anyway, point is that a quintessential example of lacking of empathy. Well, in the examples that I gave, it's present, right? So the person who comes home and talks in a grandiose way about what they did at work, and there's emotional pressure to praise them, that lacks empathy because they might not want to do that right now. They might even be given indications like their eyes are glazing over, but to the narcissistic individual, they don't necessarily register that the other person isn't enjoying the conversation. They might not, and narcissistic people also don't have a lot of eye contact, so they might not even look at you to see how it's affecting you. Or if they see that you're getting a little tired, you know, it's 45 minutes in and he comes home and you're doing dishes or something, you're standing next to the sink while he's talking about how awesome he is, and you're like, you don't want to turn back to the to do the dishes because you know that will upset him. And so you're just standing there with your gloves on, a sink full of dishes, and you're like, the narcissist individual, they don't even register that. Or if they see indications of that, they'll get really upset and they won't care about what they're doing to you. Okay, so that's a lack of empathy. If you were to undermine your subordinate, you lack empathy for that subordinate. You don't care about their feelings. You're impaired about your caring of their feelings because you're so desperate to run away from emptiness and feeling normal, because because if you feel normal and not superior, what you really feel is completely inferior. You feel like you're completely worthless and no one will ever love you.
I ask you to give the record evidence of Mr. Depp's lacking empathy that you know of.
Yes. I'll make it more direct. So if you're not agreeing with what Mr. Depp has to say, you are no longer useful. Okay, therefore, you don't really care about others for others.
Yeah, this is egregious. Where's the data? Now, maybe he has sound data to base this on, because we just don't know. We don't know all the data that was given to them. If you printed it all out, it would be several, inches high of stacks of papers of medical records and depositions and all that kind of stuff. So who knows? But I can't imagine that there's data to support what he's saying right now. I mean, it's just atrocious. When Dr. Curry was asked, why did you diagnose Amber Heard? She gave viable responses. I will even say to that, if I were to do forensic psychology work, of course, I would do that. But so I'm not even of the sort that would diagnose based on what Dr. Curry did. And of course, Dr. Curry had all the access and testing and da-da-da, which is standard forensic psychology. But what he's doing is just amazing. And like I've been saying this from the beginning, that or since I've been wondering what's going on here, I don't even think Dr. Hughes would say this. And my suspicion, and maybe they'll call her back on and she'll support. I doubt it though, honestly, because Dr. Hughes seems more buttoned up than he is. And I wonder if the Amber Heard team was like, well, this guy will say anything, so put him up there. So he's saying that, let's rewind this because it's a pretty incredible statement. So they objected, which was good, because the objection, I believe, was he's just randomly saying things without any kind of support. And so they came back and the Amber Heard lawyer says, okay, base it on the evidence of record. You're not just supposing, you actually have concrete data of some sort to base your opinion on. And so that she re-asked the question and then he goes off again without any reference to the record. So, but let's rewind this.
So if you're not agreeing with what Mr. Depp has to say, you are no longer useful. Okay, therefore, you don't really care about others for others. You care about others for your benefit. So off and on dismissing Dr. Kipper for Dr. Kipper setting some boundaries on substance use protocol, substance detox, is an example of lacking empathy and not really caring what other people have to say.
Wow. I think what he's referring to is that while Johnny Depp was going through recovery, I mean, and you've heard me say this before, Johnny Depp's recovery was pretty shaky anyway, even though he was going to treatment, meaning that he would abstain from some drugs but not others, that kind of thing anyway. So, I'm not saying that Johnny Depp was somehow going through recovery in this very standard way or in a way that experts would recommend that he go through. But anyway, regardless of that, and I guess as a product of that, he's working with Dr. Kipper, who is his lead medical physician regarding his substance abuse and addiction recovery. And according to Dr. Spiegel, Johnny Depp would not comply or would refute certain things that the physician was telling him to do. Well, one, that's normal to do when you are struggling with an addiction because you want to hold on tight to substance use, or at least the option to use. And I don't think he ever really went through recovery because I never heard, maybe he did, but I never heard that he was going to daily meetings, that he was abstaining from all sorts of things, that he had a sponsor and that he had ongoing treatment. I heard detox, I heard nurse and physician, maybe some therapy around that, but I didn't hear a strong recovery set of behaviors. So that stands to reason that the doctor and him would disagree because the doctor was probably telling him things like, look, you got to not use, we're getting you off opiates, but you can't smoke marijuana. You can't drink. I mean, maybe one day, maybe one day, but given the risks here of possible death, I mean, just think about Demi Lovato, right? I did a whole series of episodes, if you know that series, it's just like, if you present the way Demi Lovato does and the way Johnny Depp does, like, you do not want to be taking substances. So they probably disagreed because he wasn't ready to do that, which often people will do. They're not ready to do that. And so I think he's referring to that. And that is an example of lacking empathy. Is that what we're on right now?
You are no longer useful. Okay, therefore, you don't really care about others for others. You care about others for your benefit. So off and on dismissing Dr. Kipper for Dr. Kipper setting some boundaries on substance use protocol, substance detox, is an example of lacking empathy and not really caring what other people have to say.
Yeah, I mean, if he was like that in general, Johnny Depp, and you had multiple relationship types to draw from, then maybe. But the way he's phrasing it, it's very speculative based on extremely limited information. And there's several other explanations that are more likely and or just as available to us.
All right. Another one of the characteristics that you cited was envious. Do you recall that testimony?
Yes.
What is the record evidence that Mr. Depp exhibits envy?
I think jealousy is a good start for that. I think that Ms. Heard wanting to have a career, start with that, beyond what she has, and the jealousy parts of with Mr. Franco, and I think others commented this week, Ms. Burstyn commented about things about jealousy, so I think it's pretty apparent.
No. Typically, when we're talking about jealousy and the jealousy that he's referring to, Johnny Depp being jealous of hurt that his wife was potentially cheating on him, one, if he had rational reasons to suspect that, then that's a normal feeling. Two, it's not an indication of narcissistic personality disorder. It could someone with narcissism be jealous, yeah, but that's not... Well, the first example he gave was along the lines of narcissism. It's pretty dubious in terms of drawing any conclusion from anything there, but the rest of them aren't, and I wonder if he doesn't have a firm grasp on the disorder. But anyway, so envy, when we're talking about narcissistic personality disorder, we're not talking about envy and jealousy like, oh, my partner is cheating on me. You know, that's more attachment insecure behavior, particularly, again, if you have reasons to be. But, okay, what we're talking about is that person has things or accolades or respect or money or a higher position. I am envious of that because when I look at them, they have more than me in my eyes, and that threatens the idea that I'm superior, so I have envy for that, and I will be thinking about and almost obsessed about and or will actively try to get that either in parallel with them or away from them. So I'll just reuse the example I gave earlier. You have a subordinate who is getting a lot of accolades, and even though you're also getting accolades, you're envious that they're getting what in your eyes is seems more accolades, even though you might be getting 10 times more than them, but the fact that they're getting accolades feels as though you're not. And so you have envy for those accolades, and then you undermine them or fire them or something because you're envious of that. Or you start to put them behind you and go, look at me at work, and you take all the accolades. That's what we're referring to when we're talking about envy, not being jealous of your partner potentially cheating on you and you have some evidence that they might be cheating on you.
Okay. And the next one you listed was fragile self-esteem. Do you recall that?
Yeah.
And what is the record evidence of Mr. Depp exhibiting that?
So fragile self-esteem would be more along the line of a cluster B trait. I should put that in. It's not necessarily the criteria for narcissism. So it's a trait. And basically what that means will be that the combination of poor self-control and rapid mood states is fragile self-esteem, fragile personality. So traits. So it would go in the line of cluster B rather than per se narcissistic.
All right, now we've seen Mr.
I don't know what he just said. Now, one, they're talking about self-esteem, which, yeah, it's not usually the first thing that people talk about when they talk about narcissism, but in my experience with treating a lot of people with narcissism, that is the foundation, is not only low self-esteem, they don't even know who they are. They're running towards defining themselves constantly through superiority because they don't even know what they are or who they are or if they have any baseline worth.
Okay. And you also reviewed Dr. Curry's notes and her testing, correct?
Yes.
All right. And what, if any, evidence did you find in any of Dr. Curry's testing that Amber Heard had either borderline personality disorder or histrionic personality disorder?
She had traits. She did not meet the full, on her own evaluation, she did not have the full endorse enough criteria to meet the criteria for borderline personality disorder. and or histrionic personality disorder. She definitely had traits. She did not have the disorder by going by the strict number of criteria.
Okay, so he's asked directly, you reviewed the Dr. Curry materials. Do you agree with Dr. Curry's finding? And he says, no, she had traits, but not the full-blown disorder. On one hand, that lends credibility because Dr. Hughes essentially said there was no indication or no signs of it at all. And maybe there aren't. But he didn't have to say that, right? He could have said, I didn't see any sign of borderline or histrionic. I didn't see any justification for the diagnosis. But he didn't. He volunteered a detail that he wasn't being asked about, that she had traits, but not the full-blown disorder. Well, that's interesting. And I think what that says to me as a viewer, that there's even more evidence, I suppose, that she might suffer from borderline in particular, because he says, I saw some traits.
So battered wife syndrome, which is more sub-syndromal or not quite PTSD, has 70 symptoms of PTSD. And if you hear some of them, you'll see why someone might think that. They do have reliving experiences as if feeling as if the abuse is happening, even if it's not upon reminders of abuse, such as getting ready to use something, getting ready to use a substance or something along that line. They do have hyperarousal. They do have hypervigilance, which is very easily mistaken for the emotional reactivity of borderline personality disorder. They do have avoidance symptoms, so they avoid emotions, activities, people, and if that can't be happening, they start becoming much more anxious, much more hyper.
Okay, it's a good question to ask and a good thing for them if they want to cast doubt on the diagnosis of Amber Heard of borderline. Again, I want to say that even if she does have borderline, that doesn't mean that she loses the case by any means. And I'll also remind everyone that Johnny Depp in all likelihood has something. I've been trying to think what he would have if based on what I've seen or what hypothesis I would develop. And I can't really think of any particular personality disorder. The set of personality disorders is just one set of possible personality pathology. We don't always necessarily need the DSM to, you know, define individuals, but if I was to take a guess, I would say that he exhibits general attachment insecurity, and that's not a diagnosis. I don't even know if that's true, but well, gee, there's got to be something I can say about schemas. We see, I think, masochism, at least that emerges at certain times, you know, with the knife and threatening to hurt himself and drinking himself. When he's angry and rageful, he, I don't know, seems to go inward and attack himself. Like there was that scene where he's smashing the cupboards and he's like, you know, and he pours this big glass of wine. But I'm guessing there's a part of him that's just like, I'm going to do this to me. Now you could say it's also just like an addiction behavior, but who knows? So when we are being abused, what's happening is confusing to children. They're just like, so I don't understand how the world works and I don't understand my place in it. I don't understand my value, but I'm being treated very poorly. You know, not only is the mom being physically abusive, but she was emotionally and verbally abusive as well. I mean, she would insult all the kids, had, you know, hurtful nicknames. And so he, you know, he's being treated that way. And you start to build this belief system that helps you to predict the future. And for people that go through that, they sometimes will have this belief system that they deserve it, that they deserve to be abused, because that must be why would this be happening if I didn't deserve it? I must deserve it. That must be why. Not all abused kids will have that conclusion. They often do. And then the schema now becomes solidified or hardened in the personality. It can be dismantled with a lot of corrective experience and introspection and therapy. But that becomes a solid part of the personality to some extent, and they walk around with this assumption that they deserve to be mistreated. And so this belief, this assumption about the way the world works and the way you fit in the world compels a defense, because you are constantly having this intrusive thought that you deserve to be punished, you deserve to be harmed. It's around every corner because of who you are, not because of the way other people are treating you, not because of your circumstance. You just, because of who you are, you deserve to be harmed by other people. Then over time, you need to develop some way of coping with that intrusive thought. One way is to surrender to it, which is to invite abusive people into your life. Another way is to overcompensate by abusing other people, because you're going to be like, I'll be damned if I'm going to be the abused person. I'll be the abusive person and make sure that no one ever abuses me, because I'm going to always be dominant physically. The third way is to avoid the whole topic altogether because it's so painful. So you might avoid relationships, for example. So those are the three ways in which we can categorize different responses, different defenses, or maladaptive coping to this schema. Does he have that schema? Perhaps, and we could certainly slot in certain aspects of his life to fit in the maladaptive schema, right? And some people will have multiple ways of coping with their maladaptive schema. They might invite abusive people into their life, and they might also occasionally overpower others to make sure that they're never being abused. I mean, it certainly would explain some of what seems to be happening in some of the audio in which Johnny Depp is being yelled at, being told that he doesn't deserve to be respected. You know, when she's saying, I didn't punch you, I just hit you. You know, I think a lot of people would just walk out at that point, or they do say, what did you just say? Whereas if you have a belief that you deserve to be hit, then there's a big voice in your head that's just like, well, yeah, I mean, part of that is right. Not only do I deserve to be hit, but I also don't necessarily deserve any kind of respect about that event. So I guess that, but there's a part of you that's like, no, I don't want to be that way. And so you stay in contact, always trying to convince the other person, when in reality, you're kind of trying to convince yourself. I would say that he possibly has another schema similar to what is being proposed for Amber, which is the basis for borderline personality disorder, which is a schema of abandonment, meaning that people with borderline typically have a schema that they are abandonable and other people will abandon them. Sometimes it's betrayal that is infused in there, or it's only betrayal, but abandonment, betrayals, being wronged unfairly by other people in a really severe way. He exhibits some signs of that. The jealousy, the way that he talks, the desperation upon meeting her, the way in which he fell in love deeply with her because she was so pursuing of him. I think that allowed him to put down his walls and allow his inner preoccupied person to come forward. You know, obviously there's almost no evidence of this, but there's some signs of that. That would be an hypothesis that I would pursue, and a desperation for finally having some sort of attachment security. That would be my guess. And some people might say, okay, well, that doesn't sound as bad as a personality disorder. It can be as bad. There's no way of saying what I just said and comparing that to someone with borderline and saying that one would exhibit more problematic behaviors, because it just doesn't work that way.
Aroused. They have disturbances in relationships, which clearly can be an issue. Intimacy problems, again, which could also resemble borderline personality disorder. So those description and traits that were there, A, did not meet the full criteria for borderline, and B, could readily easily be explained by Bader Weiss syndrome.
Right. So what they're making a case for is that the behaviors that Dr. Curry observed and the testing revealed her battered wife syndrome, meaning her PTSD, rather than her borderline personality. Well, there's some evidence to refute that, because that would be a valid question to bring up, because if she only exhibited these behaviors with Johnny Depp, then that wouldn't necessarily indicate a personality disorder. It could, because some people can hold it together in other relationships, and then it all comes out in their romantic relationship in particular. But we didn't hear that. Right in the very beginning, we heard Ms. James, her Amber Heard's former assistant, talking about how dramatic she was, how rageful she was at Ms. James, how selfish she was, how reactive she was, not only to Johnny Depp, but also to her, Ms. James.
Thank you. Now, you also indicated earlier that you reviewed the deposition of Amy Banks.
Now, having said that, could someone with PTSD from being abused, could they also exhibit a reactivity to anyone, not just Johnny Depp? Yeah, absolutely. I guess I can add that to a possibility.
Thank you. Michelle, can you now bring up 1831?
Okay, so I think what we're seeing here is vandalism to his own house or to a hotel room or something by Johnny Depp, I'm thinking, that was directed at Amber Heard, and it says, good luck and be careful at top or something. Good luck and be careful at top. Now, they're talking about ecstasy and cocaine. There seems to be this idea among the lawyers that if we can demonstrate that Johnny Depp was using all these various different things, then that means that this would happen. And I'm just like, what? Have I heard that someone was taking cocaine and ecstasy? I wouldn't know anything about anything, because how much did they take? How much tolerance do they have to that? What was their state of mind? All, you know, there's all sorts of things that would play into. I wouldn't be able to know anything about their behavior. I might take some guesses to what they'd be doing. Like, I would guess, well, they're probably not going to sleep very well, and they probably will want to hang with other people of a similar energy level. They might be a little amorous, but not necessarily. Obviously, they could be agitated, for sure. And there seems to be a similar idea being floated that Amber Heard was using a lot of drugs, and thus that says something, which it doesn't to me.
And what, if any, evidence does this...
Okay, I actually had to Google it because I can't read it. But, and apparently this is from earlier testimony with Amber Heard that I haven't gotten to yet, but I'm almost there. In the red, I think it says, "Call Carly Simon. She said it better, babe. Call Carly..." So Carly Simon wrote a song, "She's So Vain." Is that what he's referring to? And then it also says, "She loves naked photos of her of herself. So modern, so hot." Okay. So it looks like it's a written form of the kind of verbal abuse that Johnny Depp would say and text. It also looks maybe drug-induced slightly. I don't know that, of course. I think sober he was capable of thinking such things. What does this say? The way I interpret this is that they had some horrible fights, verbal fights. We could speculate as to certain levels of violence between the two, but I think it's clear that they yelled at each other, insulted each other, called each other names frequently, and I would say that this is a manifestation of that. I would even speculate that they were fighting a lot, fighting a lot, fighting a lot. He used substances to escape more and more and more in this episode. This is pure speculation. He goes into a bathroom because that's where he would go to escape and locks the door. And he has a bit of a meltdown and writes a bunch of things on a mirror. Are these the worst things that we've heard from him? No. Carly Simon said it better. If someone insulted me that way, I'd be like, oh, that's a good one.
Correlate with behavior indicative of IPV perpetration.
Again, this is intimidation, psychological abuse, where you're solely trying to emotionally...
Objection, Your Honor. Can we be heard?
Okay.
All right, well, that does it for that episode. Everyone out there, please take care of yourself, because you deserve it. You really, really do. Hey, deserving listeners, Johnny Depp, Amber Heard trial. Let's watch. My name is Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and a professor. Let's watch.
Testimony?
Yes, I do.
And what is your opinion?
I have a couple of primary opinions. The first is that my opinion is that he violated the ethical principles that are outlined in the Goldwater Rule when he gave his opinions about Mr. Depp, specifically with relationship to personality traits and...
Wow. So this is vindicating for me, because I was saying that, and also me. I mean, who cares about me? It's Johnny Depp's team that is looking for vindication on what Dr. Spiegel was saying. So he is called in specifically to comment on Dr. Spiegel. It's interesting because he said he was sitting in the audience, and Johnny Depp's team knew to have him observe because they suspected that he was going to say something, or maybe they even knew what he was going to say. Anyway, so he is saying, as a psychiatrist, Dr. Spiegel violated the ethical standard of the Goldwater Rule, which, in terms of the way I interpret that ethical guideline, not only just for psychiatrists, but for everyone in our field, including forensic psychologists, by the way, I was interpreting it that way. So maybe there's a lot of people that would agree with Dr. Spiegel, but in my circle, this represents what my circle would say.
And his cognitive abilities. My second primary opinion would be that Dr. Spiegel's opinions were unreliable, and that he had insufficient
objection,
information.
Objection, Your Honor.
All right.
Okay, so one, that he violated the Goldwater Rule, and two, that his conclusions were based on insufficient information.
better defined and expanded in some to some degree. So, for example, in 2017, in this publication, the APA...
Right, so I don't know if you remember me talking about this earlier. I'm pretty sure I mentioned it, that every time a new president is elected, there is a lot of talk about diagnosing from afar and the Goldwater Rule. And in particular, it was necessary to discuss this in 2017 when Donald Trump became president. And there were a lot of clinicians who came forward stating publicly that Donald Trump was unfit for office due to a psychiatric disorder, which I've already been over that. It's ridiculous to claim that you could claim he's a terrible president. You could claim that he shouldn't be in office. You can claim that he's a dangerous, horrible human being. Those aren't diagnoses. That there's no ethical code regarding a psychiatrist who, during their off hours, makes a proclamation that a politician is a danger to us all. There's no ethical code around that, generally speaking, depending on what you say. But there is an ethical code about diagnosing someone from afar and saying because of that diagnosis, they are unfit for their office. So in 2017, there were a lot of clinicians. And by the way, I don't make any friends. I say this every time. Everyone in my circle, for the most part, it was not fond of Donald Trump. I'll just put it that way. So when I speak out against it, I'm not speaking in support of Donald Trump. I'm speaking in support of my profession, of all of our professions as mental health clinicians. I'm trying to defend us. I'm not trying to defend a president. Plus, if we allow that to happen, then when a Democratic president is elected, then all the Republican psychiatrists and mental health clinicians can diagnose that person and deem that person to be unfit for office. Do we want to live in that kind of society, that kind of ridiculousness? I would say not. So let's just follow our ethical codes. Now, I believe in 2017, the argument by those who were coming forward were saying that they have to follow Tarasoff, which is a legal / ethical guideline for most mental health clinicians, dictating that if we hear from, while we're working, from a client, say, who says that they're going to kill someone or harm someone, that we actually have to do what we can to preserve life, to warn that individual, call the police, or if we have the actual name of the person, actually reach out to them and say, by the way, my client said that they're going to hurt you. There's new wants to that, but they were saying, I believe, that because these clinicians were aware that Donald Trump was going to harm other people, they had an ethical obligation to get him out of office by diagnosing something like that. I mean, it was really dubious. I mean, it was just reaching. I understand when people have political passions. I understand when people are afraid. They very well could be right. They could have been right. One could make an argument that him in office absolutely did create problems, but you know, that's for politics. That's for, you know, picketing, that's for voting, that's for op-eds, it's not for diagnosing.
That person, if it's that opinion is made using the expertise, experience, and knowledge inherent in the practice of psychiatry, that is considered a professional opinion. So it might include making a diagnosis or not making a diagnosis.
Okay, I didn't know that. So he's clarifying that the Goldwater Rule has been refined over time for psychiatrists, and it doesn't just pertain to diagnoses. It includes any professional opinion. I'm guessing that's because there were abuses to the Goldwater Rule by people saying, look, I didn't diagnose the person. I was just labeling them as having narcissistic traits or that kind of silliness. And they said, okay, well, I guess we have to include all professional opinions. And he's saying that that does pertain. That is specific. Defined according to him, and I believe him, and it does pertain to what Dr. Spiegel was saying yesterday. Yeah,
but there are exceptions and situations in which an expert can give testimony in court. So one good example would be if there was a medical malpractice case, or if there was a case that involved a patient who'd committed suicide, and the courts wanted to find out whether the psychiatrist had followed appropriate practice. The expert can review medical records and can give an opinion based on those records, provided those records have sufficient information, for example, about...
Right. So that's another example of a clinician providing a professional opinion in court without having directly evaluated the individual in question, that if someone dies by suicide and an expert is called in to review the case, the professional will look at the notes, will gather all the information they can, and try to determine the accuracy of the diagnosis, the treatment, all that kind of thing. So, yeah, there are exceptions to that. But I don't think this applies. I'm guessing that's what he's going to say.
Well, my opinion is that he did not. He expressed a number of professional opinions about Mr. Depp that we heard about yesterday. Again, he did so without an evaluation, without consent. He did not follow the guidelines of the APA in the 2017 revision, where it was considered important that there be sufficient information obtained by that expert to give an opinion.
Yeah, I was saying this at the time, but particularly now, the way that he presented himself, not only in his testimony, but in his demeanor, to me, it just seemed to call everything he was saying, or most of what he was saying, into question. And I don't know the jury's take.
Make it seem like Mr. Depp met criteria for narcissistic personality traits. And I'll just mention a couple of them just to illustrate my opinion is that testimony did not really hold together. So he stated, for example, that one of the criteria for narcissism is narcissistic personality disorder is a sense of entitlement. And the example Dr. Spiegel gave is that he believed that Ms. Heard married him for his money. So clearly, sense of entitlement is from a psychiatry perspective, that's very different from a belief that someone wanted you for your money.
Yeah, I mean, I was saying that in the previous video as well. I hope he elaborates a little bit on that, but yeah, I was saying essentially the same thing.
A second example that was given was that he was asked to give an example of how Mr. Depp had shown that he was envious of others, which is another criterion for narcissistic personality disorder. And the example that Dr. Spiegel gave is that Mr. Depp was jealous of Ms. Heard because he believed she was having an affair with Mr. Franco. Now, if we look at these two terms as a psychiatrist, there's a big difference between being envious and being jealous.
Yeah, I was saying the same thing in a less articulate, concise manner. Yeah, I'm glad. I'm so glad that he is on the stand. This is very satisfying to watch.
As a psychiatrist, when I think about envy, I think about somebody wants something that someone else has, and it makes them get
that. Your Honor, I think this is going beyond his information.
He's giving his opinion as to how Dr. Spiegel violated the Goldwater rule with respect to his testimony about narcissistic personality traits.
He did, but now sustained the objection. Next question.
Okay.
How do you sustain that objection? He was about to explain the difference between envy and jealousy, which is a central feature of the testimony that Dr. Spiegel gave, and absolutely is a sound rebuttal.
Yeah, so the mini mental status is, it's a series of about 10 or 11 questions and tasks that someone completes, and you get a score out of 30. What Dr. Spiegel testified was that Mr. Depp could not recall three words after 5 minutes. And he used that as an example of Mr. Depp having cognitive deficits that he specifically attributed to Mr. Depp's alcohol and substance abuse. He really did not have sufficient information. I liken a mini mental status exam, it's like taking someone's temperature.
Yeah, I don't know if I said this at the time, but I was thinking the same thing, which is that the mini mental status exam, the purpose of it is to catch things if you can, because we might miss something in the overall interview. It's designed to be a series of short questions. If they indicate something, then you would want to go down a road. So if you, for example, had a patient that couldn't remember the standard number of items on the three, you give three words, tell me all the words that you remember that I said a little bit ago. If the person indicated they didn't understand any of the words, you would not diagnose from that data point. You would say, okay, now let's maybe, or you would say maybe tomorrow we're going to have to do this other memory test. And the official tests that are available to forensic individuals are elaborate, and they're standard, and they're well known. they take a while to take. Processing speed is the same thing. You would never look at someone, give a... If that was true, then why do we have the tests?
Do you agree with Dr. Spiegel that the Goldwater rule doesn't apply to expert witnesses?
I don't agree, no.
How could Dr. Spiegel express an opinion without violating the Goldwater rule?
This has actually been a topic that's been written and published about, so it is possible for someone to give testimony.
I'm really glad that they're touching on this. I don't know exactly what he's going to say, but what I would say is things I was saying before, which is to say this is speculative based on what I have observed without having evaluated the person in question. There are signs of this, but I don't know if they actually suffer from that or if those indications are signs of something else or signs of nothing. But I will tell you that if I saw that, then I would wonder if this was the case. That's one option that I often will say when I'm providing content on the internet.
However, what he should have done in expressing his opinion is then have followed up to say that in order to really establish whether these were relevant and significant cognitive deficits, Mr. Depp should have had psychological testing to establish the nature of these deficits.
Yes, especially when it comes to memory and processing speed. Those are very specific things that we have very specific instruments around. And I don't know anyone that I've heard of who would try to, you would maybe take guesses, but they would say, but you know, we got to do the test because the tests are very good at testing that sort of thing. Like one of the processing speed tests that I remember using involved this grid of different circles and shapes and colors, and you had to circle, you're looking at the word red, but it's in the color of blue, and you have to go as fast as you can. So that's processing speed, right? Because you're reading the word, and there's a little bit of a thing, you know, okay, look at the color, don't look at the word. And the slower the processing, I'm pretty sure this measures processing speed. And then we have these standardized in terms of administer, the researchers that develop these instruments will administer it to thousands of people and will get norms, meaning averages or bell curves for a certain age group. And then when you get your score, you compare your score with people in your age group or whatever sort of grouping you are comparing yourself to, and then you get a where you are in terms of the average and standard deviation. Clinicians need to be there because you never know the state of the patient that is taking these tests. You know, if you just gave these tests online, you can't guarantee that their space is quiet, that the individual isn't distracted. That's why it requires professionals to administer these tests and to code them and to interpret them with expertise.
If you gave an opinion about cognitive deficits that required psychological testing to be further evaluated.
And that explains maybe the way in which he came across, how unprepared he seemed to be to me, how unrefined his answers were, how unconvincing he seemed, how random some of his responses were, how almost reckless. I mean, there were things that he said that I thought were actually counter to the Amber Heard team's opinion. And his use of language, like the word idiot. Yeah, from about halfway through Dr. Spiegel's testimony, I was like, does this guy know what he's doing? And I don't know, maybe he does. But then there's this further speculation that I had, which is that the Amber Heard team was desperately looking for someone who would diagnose Johnny Depp so that they could influence the jury. And they, I'm guessing, I don't know, asked a lot of forensic psychologists and offered a lot of money. And the forensic psychologists, including Dr. Hughes, I'm guessing, said, no, I can't do that. That's just not, unless he submits to an evaluation, there's no way I can confidently or ethically diagnose him with anything. So they found someone that didn't know what they were doing, that didn't know about the profession, that didn't know about the ethics involved. I mean, I'm speculating upon speculations.
Dr. Shah, yesterday Dr. Spiegel was talking about correlation and causation. What is the difference between correlation and causation?
Yeah, so when he was asked that question, Dr. Spiegel, he said correlation meant risk factor and causation meant you had it. Smoking is, according to what he was saying, a correlation because it's correlated with lung cancer and emphysema. So it's a risk factor. And then causation is actually having it. It was weird. So I hope that they go over this.
So a correlation doesn't say anything about whether or not these factors caused the behavior he was discussing. Perhaps one of the easiest ways I could describe this difference between correlation and causation is if we look at the issue of measles, if you bear with me. So there's a correlation between being young and catching measles. Now, we know that measles is not caused by being young. Measles is caused by a virus. But young children have not been exposed to the virus. They don't have the immunity, so they have a higher rate of measles. So the difference statistically is, well, the difference is between causation and correlation is illustrated by that example. So,
yes, that's a much better explanation of correlation and causation. Yeah, this is just so satisfying. Dr. Spiegel's testimony and the questions that he was being asked by Amber Heard's lawyer, I just felt like I was in a strange world. Like, I just felt like, what is going on right now? And it's just so nice to hear things that I'm very familiar with being said.
Another way I might put this is if we had 100 people in a room, just bringing it back to the issue of IPV that Dr. Spiegel was testifying about. Let's say we had 70 people who had all the risk factors for IPV and 30 people who had no risk factors for IPV. So what can we say about those 70 people? We can't say that any single one of those people has perpetrated IPV, even though they may have all the risk factors. And if we look at the 30 people who have no risk factors, we also can't say whether or not they have.
This is such an excellent analogy. I can't believe how good this guy is. I mean, that's perfect. That's perfect.
I perpetrated IPV. So the actual presence of risk factors for IPV that Dr. Spiegel was talking about, they say absolutely nothing about what happened in this case.
People who listen to my podcast, when I review ethical cases in which clinicians who have committed ethical violations or illegal acts while they are in the process of helping or working with clients, working professionally. In fact, I just got an email from my malpractice insurance giving a lot of examples of people who have been successfully sued. I love these briefs, these case briefs that they send out, because it's good podcast content, but it also just gives real life examples of how courts and ethical boards tend to rule on these things. Because in my field, mental health clinicians, they often will tell each other what is the law or how it's regulated or what the ethical codes mean. We, as a group, when we just decide that on our own, we tend to believe things that aren't true. Like, rumors kind of get swirled around because there's so much ambiguity. It's hard to know exactly how to interpret these ethical codes and laws sometimes. And so when I actually get these examples of how the courts rule, how the ethical, the licensing boards, how they will rule on things. And they're not always consistent, but they're often different than the way that people will believe. And by the way, that rumor process results in professors and supervisors that will perpetuate these rumors. It's like this weird closed system that doesn't often interact with the actual places in which these decisions are being made. That doesn't mean that these people are worthless, but what I tell people, clinicians out there, if you ever want to get consultation from someone that actually knows ethics and law in our field, you have to work with someone that actually goes to those places where the decisions are being made. You can't learn that from a book. The books don't always tell us exactly what, and things change over time. Courts will change, licensing boards will change over time. And so the people that I go to, and I've had them on the podcast before, are people that actually work in those cases. Like, I have a friend who is an attorney and a clinician, and she actually will defend fellow clinicians or be part of the complaining process against a clinician. And she knows exactly how all those things work. She understands how judges work, how licensing boards will work. And thus, her knowledge is actually ground level and very sound and very buttoned up and very valuable. And sometimes it completely contradicts what you will learn in a graduate school class on ethics, which is bizarre, really. Not all the time, obviously. So I'm saying all this because for Dr. Spiegel, he might have a lot of colleagues that he works with who think everything that he did was totally fine, but it's because they're in this weird equity. Another aspect of this that I should mention is that a lot of mental health clinicians, particularly people of certain identities, white men, I suppose, they believe that they're beyond reproach. I've seen this attitude before. You know, when you become a and I'll just speak from my own experience. When you become a therapist, you're kind of the, especially when you no longer have a supervisor and you're free to practice without oversight, which is pretty early in one's career, you're kind of the king of your own domain because clients come in and you treat them and you say lots of things and you advise in certain ways and you provide research or whatever. And no one's really there to refute you. No one is really there to criticize you in a way that seems very valid. I mean, certainly people will criticize, but often it's not coming from a place of expertise. It's just a client that just doesn't like what you're doing or whatever. And of course, we're trained to listen to that. But you end up starting to really feel, and a lot of clients will be very grateful for your help. And so there's this temptation to start to believe that you know more than what you know, and you're competent in areas when you're not actually competent. It reminds me of when Julius Caesar and other generals, when they were given a tribute in Rome, having conquered Gaul and all these places, the tribute was the pinnacle of someone's life. If you could have a tribute, you know, it's this big parade and party in Rome that honors you, that they would have a slave that would be right next to you at all times, frequently telling you, you're not a god, you're human. You're not a god, you're human. I like that image, that they would have some kind of measure in place to make sure that the individual, although we are elevating you, you're not God. You're still a human being. And remember to be humble. Remember to know your limitations, even though no one else is around to necessarily point that out. You know, when you're in graduate school, you're constantly being reminded of how limited you are because you're comparing yourself to your classmates, to your professors. You're just like, man, I feel like I'm completely lost. I have no idea what's happening. So then also professors even have it worse because when you're a professor, you often feel like you're even further up the ladder, and you're the master of training other therapists. You know stuff. And of course, students don't know enough necessarily to criticize you, or they don't feel safe enough to criticize you. And so you do this long enough, you can really start believing that you know everything and you can do anything. And I've seen people exhibit seemingly that attitude. And I will say that I have suffered from that at times, for sure, where, I mean, not to that degree that I would say, but times where I start to forget my limitations. I start to forget to be humble. I start to believe that I am smart on all things and will comment on all things. I don't know if that is happening in this situation, but, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't a factor.
You're not offering any opinion as to Mr. Depp's psychology, correct?
That's correct.
That's such a ridiculous question. I mean, I guess it's relevant, but it's like, well, what do you think? Yes, of course, I haven't evaluated. That's the whole point. In fact, yes, I'm not offering an opinion on him because I didn't evaluate him, and Dr. Spiegel should have said the same thing.
And you, before this case, you've never offered an opinion on the Goldwater Rule before, correct?
That's correct.
And you've never written an article on the Goldwater Rule, correct?
I have not.
So... do they think this so to me, this means nothing. If anything, it points out how rare it is that someone will break the Goldwater Rule in a court case. It's like asking, have you ever given expert testimony on a psychologist, a psychiatrist who gets on the stand and then proceeds to beat up the jury? You'd be like, no, I've never given a testimony on that because it almost never happens. So... yeah. And you wouldn't need to write an article about the Goldwater Rule because it's so fundamental and easy to understand and well written about with other people. Now, maybe this is just excellent lawyership and the jury's like, oh, okay. But to me, it's like if you ask someone to come on the stand and give an opinion about IPV and they had never given a testimony about that before, they had never written any articles, they didn't have any training in it, then yeah, that calls into question their expertise. But a basic ethical code that everyone knows, it's not usually needed to write anything about that because it's not very complicated.
And you've never given a presentation on the Goldwater Rule, correct?
I have not.
And you've never been on any committees regarding the Goldwater Rule, correct?
I have not.
And you've never made a collage involving the Goldwater Rule, correct? And you've never done an interpretive dance involving the... Sorry.
And you agree that you've testified that there are exceptions to the Goldwater Rule about having to interview the subject, right?
Yes.
And you understand that Dr. Spiegel requested to meet with Mr. Depp twice, but Mr. Depp declined, correct?
I'm aware of that.
And Dr. Spiegel stated in his designation and at trial yesterday that he did not meet with Mr. Depp, right?
What's your point? I mean, maybe this is going somewhere. You're aware that he asked to talk with Johnny Depp and Johnny Depp refused, right? Yeah, that doesn't give you the right to diagnose from afar. Especially with the data he provided. I mean, if he had, you know, there's a world in which there was absolutely enough data that one could maybe make a diagnosis. I would never in that situation, but maybe. But the stuff he was pulling in as data was ridiculous.
Yes.
Okay. This objection attempts to subsume the rule with its exceptions. What this objection misses, however, is that the rendering of expertise and or an opinion in these contexts is permissible because there is a court authorization for the examination or an opinion without examination. And this work is conducted within an evaluative framework, including parameters for how and where the information may be used or disseminated.
Yes, he already talked about this. He talked about there are special cases in which you can do that, like if someone died by suicide and you asked an expert witness to come in and review the case, then yeah, those are the kinds of things where it's permitted. Not when Johnny Depp is sitting right there, and especially not when you're gathering information from, what was he saying? That Johnny Depp stated that he was jealous, and that's an indication that he has narcissistic personality disorder.
You see that?
I do, yes.
And this court authorized Dr. Spiegel to testify in this case, correct?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I have nothing further.
All right.
I mean, maybe he's reaching and he's just like, I got nothing. So, in fact, it kind of looks like that because you'd think you'd have more there. Then, yeah, he did the best job he could under the circumstances to salvage the situation because he got the expert witness to say, yes, that is saying that there are exceptions to the Goldwater rule. As I said earlier, but yes, it does say that. I have no further questions, like trying to say to the jury that, okay, case closed, let's move on. And yeah, hopefully they ask, does what Dr. Spiegel did in this case, does that, according to your opinion, meet that exception criteria in that document? It's like, no, it does not.
Dr. Shaw, Mr. Nadelhoff just asked you about the court authorization of Mr. Depp's evaluation. Are you aware that the court has twice denied Ms. Hurd's request for an evaluation of Mr. Depp?
I heard that yesterday in testimony, yes.
Okay. Thank you. Nothing further.
All right.
They should have asked that question I thought of. But maybe somehow that's helpful to the jury. I think that's a missed opportunity right there. But what do I know? I know nothing about the law. She knows a billion times more than I do. So I don't know. Maybe that was the best choice. All right. Well, that does it for that episode. Everyone out there, please take care of yourself because you deserve it. You really, really do.